Good evening. I wonder what you and your family do between the hours of 6 and 9 on a Saturday evening. Most of you, if you're like me, will be preparing for church the next day in prayer and in reading the word, I'm sure. Kendal's quite an upmarket place, so I'm sure that some of you will watch Strictly Come Dancing on BBC One. But some of you, I suspect, will watch The X Factor. Now, for those of you who don't know what The X Factor is, it's a national singing talent contest where anyone from Britain can enter. Most of them are absolutely terrible, but some make it through to the latter stages and for the chance to win the competition, to see if you have the X Factor. Now, Robin and I always end up watching this programme. I certainly never set out to watch this programme, but I'm gradually kind of sucked into it, and I watch it. Some people, like my dad, will pretend not to watch it, and will kind of quite, you know, pompously sit there with his Times newspaper with the television on. But if you watch him, you'll gradually see the paper going down and him peering over and enjoying it. And maybe texting in for the winner in the final even. I don't think he's done that. So the X Factor is a phenomenon in this country. Millions of people vote in the final. And my wife and I were in Canada for a few months recently, and lo and behold, the X Factor, exactly the same format, exactly the same judges almost, is on over there as well, in Canada and in America. Over there it's called something different. It's called Pop Idol. Pop Idol, and the American version is a bit more glitzy. The British version, believe it or not, is quite reserved in comparison to the American version. Although if you haven't seen the American version, it's quite difficult to imagine that. So the Pop Idol brand is a global brand. It's huge all over the world. In America, American Idol is the biggest program in history of American television in terms of people who watch it. Then you have Canadian Idol, which is equally very, very popular. Australian Idol, and then all the various European countries also have their own Pop Idol contests. And Simon Cowell, the judge, do you know who Simon Cowell is? The kind of slightly kind of mean judge who kind of says quite nasty things to some of the contestants. It is probably the most influential man in the media at the moment. Very rich and very influential, because the Pop Idol format brand has taken off globally. So what's the secret to Pop Idol's success? Well, I read an article recently that I thought was quite interesting. It suggested two things were behind Pop Idol's success. The first thing is that Pop Idol has tapped into our cult of fame. We idolise celebrities. You know, back in the 40s and the 50s, Dad was telling me about the 40s and the 30s, that, you know, there was a celebrity thing then. You know, Hollywood was a big thing then. But we've taken it to a whole new level in the past few decades. And you just need to look at the magazine stands in Asda to see that we're absolutely fascinated by celebrity. And people now are famous, and we can't remember why they're famous. And people like Paris Hilton, I don't know why she's famous. She's famous for being famous. So we're fascinated by this celebrity thing, and hence the success of Pop Idol, because it's all about becoming a celebrity. But then there are a few other things behind the success of Pop Idol, if you look deeper. The first thing is the whole thing about money and success. It's tapped in to this obsession we have with being successful, this individualistic thing in the West about making a success of yourself, of making lots of money, of winning that £1 million record contract. We like to see people who've made it in financial terms, who've made themselves something. And the second thing, the third thing that pop idol has tapped into is the idol of sex. You know, someone recently described our culture as being a raunch culture. You know, sex in the 60s left the marital bedroom and became a commodity. Became something of a commodity. And pop idol is undoubtedly, deliberately, a kind of sexed up program. So celebrities, money, sex. Pop idol is the context in which we can see all our Western idols. And that's the secret behind its success. And tonight I want to look at what the Bible says about idols. Now you might still be thinking that idols are not a Western thing. You know, we sometimes think of idols being an Eastern thing, don't we? We think of these shrines to gods or to demons or even to animals, cows and chickens. We think of the religious kind of shrines and statues and altars and chanting and animal sacrifices. And you certainly don't see much of that in Kendall. But the West has its own idols. We've just replaced our sacred idols for secular idols. And we build our altars to them in the same way that we used to build altars to our secular idols. Our million-pound stadiums for our sports personalities and our music stars. Our mega casinos for us to chase after our money. And we have our own rituals. We sit the family in front of the television on a Saturday night to watch our hallowed celebrities. And more importantly, we each of us have individual things that we idolise. It's not just a societal thing, it's an individual thing. And mass idolatry, what we see on pop idol, is really just the idolatry of millions and millions of individuals. So what is an idol? An idol is something that consumes us. It gives meaning to our lives. It's one of those things that makes us tick. The possible list of things is endless. Maybe it's our career. Maybe it's a relationship or the desire to be in a relationship. Maybe it's sex itself. Maybe it's physical fitness. Maybe it's something seedy like gambling or pornography. Or maybe it's something that seems very healthy like our family or our children. It could even be something religious, like an unhealthy commitment to a certain way of doing things, or to something that we do in church, whether it's the music or flower arranging, and certainly preaching has a high risk of being idolatrous. So as a society and as individuals, we all have things that we idolise. And actually, idolatry is one of the main themes of the Bible, Old Testament and New. The Bible tells us that idols are the things that capture our hearts, the things that hold our affections. And I just want to look at two individual verses tonight. We don't have, although we read some of 1 John there, I just want to look at two individual verses. So the first verse is Romans 1:25, and I put them up here so we don't need to flick between them because we'll be doing a fair bit of going between them. So Romans 1:25. Paul says, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. And then 1 John 5, verse 21, final verse of 1 John. Dear children, keep yourselves from idols. Dear children, keep yourselves from idols. The Dutch Calvinist theologian Emil Brunner said this, and I think it's one of the most poignant quotes I've heard for a long time. For every civilization, for every period of history, it is true to say, show me what kind of gods you have, and I will show you what kind of humanity you possess. So just remember that quote as we think about this subject tonight. For every civilization, for every period of history, it is true to say, show me what kind of gods you have, and I will show you what kind of humanity you possess. See, whatever captures our hearts Whatever holds our affections tells us something about ourselves, tells us something about the state of our humanity, and also, according to the Bible, tells us something about our spirituality. So I want to look at three main things this evening, quite briefly. The first thing is generally, what is the Bible's understanding of idols and idolatry? And we'll look at these two verses especially. The second thing is, why are idols such a big deal? But why are idols dangerous? So that'll be more practical. And then thirdly, I just want to think about the cross and idols. What happened on the cross and how that affects the way we see idols. Okay, so what's the Bible's understanding of idolatry? So to understand idols, as with pretty much everything in the Bible, we need to go back to the foundational chapters of Genesis 1 to 3. So we don't need to turn to them. I'll just give you a brief resume. These chapters explain who men and women are in relation to God. So Genesis 1:27 says that God created men and women, in his own image. This is very important because it shows us that men and women are very special. That there are lots of unique things about human beings in comparison to, say, another quite intelligent creature like a monkey or a dolphin. You know, we can talk. That's quite an amazing thing. We can communicate in quite a complex way. We can solve puzzles, so we can understand maths, and we can understand the universe, and all these Einstein's stuff that I don't really understand. The fact that humans can do that is quite amazing. We can write music, we can write complex music. So humans are unique in all kinds of ways. But the Bible teaches that the most amazing thing about being a man or a woman is that we're created in the image of God, and therefore have the ability to have a personal relationship with him. See, the God of the Bible is the God who talks to us and invites us to reply. There's an amazing picture in Genesis of God taking a walk in the Garden of Eden, in the coolness of the day. And he shouts for Adam and Eve, he calls them, and he gives them the opportunity to call back to him. We can assume this had happened before the fall. On this occasion, they don't talk back to him because they're ashamed of their sin. But that indicates the closeness of the relationship between God and between men and women, because we're created in his image to have a relationship with him. And the God of the Bible is an intensely personal God. You know, I love that picture in the Old Testament of Jacob wrestling with the angel. In other words, wrestling with God. And wrestling is, you can't get more personal than wrestling. You know, it's in your face. The God who is in our face. The God who demands our attention. God is an intensely personal God. So back to the Garden of Eden. This picture of closeness between men and women and God is set out as the ideal. According to Genesis, this is humanity at its best. This is our true humanity. Each of us having a personal relationship with God. Knowing him, worshipping him, putting him first in our lives. The early chapters of Genesis also teach that we live in an incredible world, a wonderful world. A world corrupted by the fall, for certain. But still, originally and resiliently incredible. In Genesis, God declares that his creation is good. And surely our experiences of the world confirm that we live in a rich, exciting, curious, wonderful creation. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins said, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God." You know, charged. We have nature to examine and to enjoy. We have the gift of culture, art, literature, music, hobbies, whatever those hobbies are, the ability to work, to create things, to forge things, to earn money, to be creative, to be original. You know, we have mountains to climb, footballs to kick, car engines to tinkle with, and steaks to eat. Lots of things for us to do. And the Bible affirms that although creation is tarnished, creation is originally good. But the crux of the issue is this. What happens when we turn these good things into ultimate things? Our first verse, Romans 1:25, puts it like this. When we worship and serve created things rather than the Creator. See, idolatry, according to Paul, is when we make these good things that God has created the God things in our lives. And we put these things before having a personal relationship with Him. It's a complex thing, idolatry, because it's not really a question of bad things and good things, or worldly things and unworldly things. Idolatry is usually a case of good things being corrupted, or perverted, or taken out of their proper context. And so we make these good things bad things. So putting creation before the Creator. When I was at university, I used to love visiting my mum and dad. I still do love visiting them. But when you have a wife, it's less of a kind of necessity to visit your mum and dad. It's not so much to do with abject poverty, or because you don't have any more clothes to wear. And there were so many things I loved about going home. Good things like mum's chocolate caramel slice, real butter, beef casserole, freshly ironed socks, folded on the chair. There are many wonderful things about visiting my mum and dad. But it would be wrong, wouldn't it, if the main thing for me was those things rather than actually seeing mum and dad themselves. There'd be something deeply wrong there. And that, in a tiny, tiny way, is the essence of idolatry. Putting things before a relationship with the individual. Putting the creation before the Creator Himself. I wonder how you define the word sin. Probably we connect it, and rightly, with doing wrong things. Breaking the rules. Violating the law. And that's true. But the root of sin is idolatry. If you think of the Ten Commandments, the first two commandments really sum up the rest of the commandments, the other eight. You shall have no gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol. Cherishing the creation and the wonderful things in the world around us more than we cherish God. And looking at Romans 1:25, Paul describes this as the foundation of all sin. In fact, the root of original sin. Exchanging the truth of God for a lie and worshipping the creation rather than the Creator. And of all the other sins, of sin itself, this is where sin stems from, this basic wrong attitude to life, where we allow something other than God to capture our hearts. Okay, so why are idols such a big deal? Why are idols dangerous? John 1 John, the finale of 1 John, the last kind of resounding message of 1 John is, dear children, keep yourselves from idols. And there's something quite paternal about that. Something quite protective. The RSV says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Why is John so concerned? The brilliant thing about the Bible is it's not just full of arbitrary commands. It's telling us to do something, but not explaining why. It gives us reasons for behaving in a certain way. And there are many reasons in the scriptures against idolatry. But here's just two. The first is this. The idols enslave. Going back to Romans 1:25, men and women do two things to idols. They worship them and they serve them. And the second word there shows us that our relationship with idols is not a one-way thing. Then our idols aren't something that we just cherish and master. Paul emphasizes that we serve them, meaning we're enslaved by them in some way. Augustine said this. He talked of the violence of a habit by which the unwilling mind is dragged down and held. The violence of a habit by which the unwilling mind is dragged down and held. There's a sense in which we're in the bondage and the grip of our idols. And with some things, this is obvious. If we look at bad idols, like drug addiction or alcohol addiction or gambling addiction, if you speak to recovering addicts, they'll quite often talk about their addiction in terms of almost a spiritual possession. This thing had some kind of power over them. That it wasn't just a one-way thing. It was mastering them. So it's true with those things we might think of as bad idols. But what about those more harmless idols? You know, when we give ourselves over to something, they begin to exercise control over us. Think about the idol of career or the idol of money. It might start off as just a kind of eager desire just to do well in the world. But what does it become? You know, how many workaholics do you know who they've been swallowed up by money and by greed and by that desire to do well? And in a sense, it masters them as much as they're the master of their careers. And they become constrained by anxiety because all they worry about is their career. And then there's sex. When we take it out of its proper context, it ceases to become a good thing and becomes an ultimate thing. It consumes people. The desire to go to the internet or to the TV for pornography, it becomes a compulsion that people feel obsessed by. So idols, Paul explains, enslave. They take away our freedom. And we live in a society that is fascinated by the idea of rights. By my rights. My right to do this. My right to do that. And people do all kinds of sinful, wrong things because they think they have a right to do certain things. But actually, idolatry takes away our rights. It takes away our rights. It enslaves us. It controls us. And we need to help people to understand that. The second thing is idols dehumanize. We talked at the beginning about the ideal for humanity. We're special, created in God's image. Our true humanity is living in a good creation and enjoying a close relationship with God. That would be humanity at its best before the fall. But the Bible teaches us that when we look to idols instead of God, we become less and less human. We move further and further away from this original good humanity. And there's an absolutely chilling psalm, Psalm 115, that describes this. I'll just read it to you. Verses 4 to 8, if you want to follow. But their idols are silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths, but cannot speak, eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but cannot hear, noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but cannot feel, feet, but they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will become like them, and so will all who trust in them. Those who make them will become like them, and so will all who trust in them. Basically, it's saying that as we serve our idols, as we're enslaved by our idols, we become less human. We move further and further away from that image, and we become dehumanized, less human. And no one understood sin and idolatry probably better than J.R. Tolkien. You know, the writer of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And in that, there's a creature called Gollum. I don't know, are people aware of this creature called Gollum? There's a hand at the back. so you all know what I'm talking about. And Gollum starts life with a different name. He's called Smeagol. And he's a very happy individual. He's quite similar to a hobbit. And hobbits are very kind of small, jolly things with hairy feet. And he lives an idyllic life by a river a happy life next to friends and family and community. He's a happy individual. But then he finds this golden ring. And he's unaware that this ring is actually a powerful object. And he becomes consumed by this golden ring. He starts to call it his precious. And keeping it, looking after that ring, becomes the most important thing in his life. He's unaware that he's becoming enslaved by that ring. And he becomes obsessed, pathetic. He turns into this kind of green, horrible, ghostly figure. As he becomes consumed by this ring, he's even willing to kill for it. He changes his name, his original name, to Gollum. And his identity changes. And he can do nothing but for his gold ring. He leaves his community and he lives in dark caves to be alone with it. And Tolkien's Gollum is an allegorical character used to describe how our idols dehumanise us and destroy us. We might think they're making us happy, but actually they're exercising some kind of control over us. They corrupt our relationship with God, that personal relationship with God. And they make us less the way we're supposed to be. And we live in a postmodern culture that values being true to yourself, being true to oneself. And the catchphrase is, I can behave like this or that because I need to be true to myself. And that's an excuse for doing all kinds of things. But the New Testament actually shows us that when we have idols, when we serve idols, whatever they are, we actually become less like ourselves. We actually move further and further away from this glorious original humanity. And things become less the way they're supposed to be. So finally, let's just look at the cross and idols. You can't really think about idols if you're a Christian without thinking about the cross. So we've seen how idolatry, letting our hearts be captured by something other than God, separates us from him. It damages that close personal relationship described in the early chapters of Genesis, and so ultimately makes us less human. It takes away our original glory and tarnishes us who are made in the image of God. When we look at the cross, we see something completely outrageous. And someone described by Luther as the crucified God. Jesus, totally God and man, who has every right to extol himself, every right to set himself up to be worshipped, instead chooses to make himself nothing. The God of Genesis, who humanity has turned its back on through its idolatry, comes to earth, lives among us, and dies the death of a criminal. He allows himself to be completely humiliated. He dies naked on a cross. In doing so, the crucified God challenges and confronts idolatry by turning idolatry on its head. And that's one of the many wonderful things about the cross, is that he was dehumanized so that we could become human again. He was dehumanized in the most violent, dramatic, terrible way so that we could have our tarnished humanity completely restored. And he died on the cross to give us the opportunity to become truly human in the way that we were talking about at the beginning again. To have that personal relationship with God completely restored. So what's the final application to this? It might be that you're not a Christian tonight and that you live for other things other than for God. And that you've turned these good things of creation into ultimate things or God things. And that you don't really have that personal relationship with the creator of those things. And can I encourage you just to think through these things seriously and maybe talk to someone who you know is a Christian or talk to an elder here at the church about that. Now the majority of people here are Christians. And we need to take John's plea to keep ourselves from idols very seriously. This involves reflection of our lives. We need to ask ourselves, what do we really cherish? What good things have we distorted or perverted? When people look at us, what do they see as our reason for living? Is it our faith, or our career, or our hobbies, or our relationships? Is there anything in our lives now that if we lost it tomorrow, we'd feel as though we were left with nothing? So as Christians, we need to, I guess, spring clean our lives quite regularly of idols. And let's do that seriously and honestly.